From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, an independent autopsy into the death of teenager Michael Brown reveals he was shot multiple times by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri.
Six bullets struck him. We don't know how many missed. The police know that, though, because they know they got his gun and they know how many shots were fired.
Also today, Kurdish forces, supported by U.S. airstrikes, are reportedly on the brink of recapturing strategic ground from IS militants. And civil unrest breaks out in West Africa as the Ebola virus continues to claim lives across the region.
This is a city and a country really gripped by fear. This affects everything in daily life. In some respects, social norms have changed overnight.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. An independent autopsy has revealed that black teenager Michael Brown, killed by police in the U.S. state of Missouri, was shot at least six times. Representatives for Michael Brown's family says the independent autopsy supports witness accounts, saying police shot Mr. Brown multiple times, and some shots were acquired while Mr. Brown's back was to police. The 18-year-old took two shots to the head and others to the right arm. Benjamin Crump, lead counsel for the Browns, says the family could not trust the initial autopsy done by police.
They did not want to be left having to rely on the autopsy done by the St. Louis law enforcement agencies, the same individuals they feel are responsible for executing their son in broad daylight.
Ukraine says a number of refugees were killed in a rocket and mortar attack on a moving convoy, which was making its way from the Luhansk area of eastern Ukraine. Ukraine pointed the finger at pro-Russian rebels, but they denied the attack, although reports say there was heavy gunfire in the area. Ukrainian forces have moved closer to the rebel-held town, where supplies are running out. Meanwhile, a Russian aid convoy headed for eastern Ukraine, which Kiev has blocked from crossing that border, remains at a standstill. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf said an agreement exists to inspect the convoy.
We understand there is an agreement that the aid will be inspected by Ukrainian border guards and customs officials before being transferred in batches to representatives of the ICRC. We also know that the ICRC has not yet received the required security guarantees from the Russian-supported separatists in Luhansk. It's also not clear whether the ICRC has received a detailed inventory list of the convoy's contents. So these are the kind of things that are holding up the aid right now. There's an agreement, but the details are still being worked.
Iraqi state and Kurdish Peshmerga forces have been fighting to reclaim the dam in Mosul from ISIS militants. The U.S. military has tried to help retake Mosul Dam, providing airstrikes. Although the Iraqi state says they have succeeded in their mission, those on the ground say the two sides are still exchanging fire. Meanwhile, as Erbil-based journalist Tracy Shelton reports, over a million displaced Iraqis continue to live in perilous situations.
They're sleeping in the streets, they're sleeping in schools, in parks, basically any spare space that they can find. Many of them aren't getting any aid at all. Nobody knows exactly where they are and how to even reach them to get the aid there. And plus, there's such an overwhelming number that there hasn't been enough to go around.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, has said he will leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London soon after 2 years inside. He was granted asylum by Ecuador after facing extradition to Sweden over allegations of sexual assault, which he denies. The 43-year-old fears he will be sent to the U.S., where authorities investigated him after WikiLeaks published classified diplomatic documents. But just when he is planning to leave the embassy and what his reasons for it will be remain unclear, as our UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
Julian Assange saying he will be leaving the embassy soon, but giving no indication as to what exactly that might mean. It has been reported that he is suffering from health problems, having been inside the embassy now for 2 years, but he said that the reasons reported in the press for him potentially leaving the embassy were probably not true. So, very unclear from Julian Assange's own words when, why, or how he might finally leave this embassy.
A health organization that operates 206 hospitals across the U.S. says hackers may have stolen data from as many as 4.5 million patients. The community health databases that were targeted included personal information such as patient names, addresses, birth dates, and social security numbers. Rebecca Bowering reports.
In a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, Community Health Systems said the security breach happened between April and June of this year. It's thought to be the work of a hacker group in China. In a rash of attacks, they used advanced malware to break into community health networks and transfer data out. None of it was medical in nature. The assault appears to echo those of a unit of the Chinese army accused of targeting American, Canadian and British companies numerous times since 2006. Community Health is working with cybersecurity experts to investigate the incident.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
They did not want to be left having to rely on the autopsy done by the St. Louis law enforcement agencies, the same individuals they feel are responsible for executing their son in broad daylight.
Attorney Benjamin Crump on why the family of Michael Brown conducted a private autopsy, which Monday revealed the teenager was shot as many as six times by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri last Saturday. The medical examiner working on behalf of the deceased's family said at least two of the bullets struck Mr. Brown in the head. The National Guard, requested by the state governor, is now in the suburb of St. Louis following an eighth night of violence, although no curfew has been enforced for Monday night. During a brief break from his vacation, President Obama met with Attorney General Eric Holder to discuss the Ferguson situation. Colin Jeffrey is news director at local radio news station KTRS.
Well, the National Guard has been called in by Governor Jay Nixon. They don't think that the Highway Patrol and county and local police can effectively handle the crowds after dark. So the National Guard is arriving on scene, and it appears the tactics are already changing how they're going to deal with protesters and media through the day. The burned out QT that has sort of become the symbol of the protests and kind of ground zero for all of this, they are now telling media and protesters they're not allowed to gather there. They have to keep walking. So it appears the rule is now on West Florissant, where much of this unrest has been centered, there are no more static gatherings for the time being. People have to be either actively demonstrating or, walking. They don't want groups of people just milling about.
Indeed. Important developments in this case today. We've heard from the medical examiner employed by the family of the shooting victim, Michael Brown. Can you tell us a bit about what he had to report back?
Well, he's a very well-known medical examiner. He's testified in cases as an expert in St. Louis, in Missouri, and few key findings. The most important thing, Michael Brown was shot a total of six times, he said, and the fatal shot appears to have been one that hit the top of the head. And that's what we know is fatal. The medical examiner, Dr. Bodden, said it appears Michael Brown could have survived the other shots, but that's the kill shot. He didn't say what order the shots came in. He was also unable to confirm which direction that fatal shot came. If it was from the front, as the police are saying, or as some eyewitnesses say, if it came while Michael Brown was trying to run away and came from the back. So that's the largest thing that came from that. We also know that the gun was not within a foot or two of Michael Brown, from what we can tell. He investigated the body and said there doesn't appear to be any gunpowder residue on the body. However, to make certain of that, he needs to get a closer look at Brown's clothes and has not had that opportunity, is what we gathered today.
You've been at the scene of this unrest and protest and police reaction since this incident first began. Can you explain what the difference is between what's happening during the day? You referred to they're having to bring in that National Guard for a response to them, what happens come the evening. Can you explain that transformation?
Well, the biggest difference seems to be during the day, It's a lot of residents from Ferguson. And this is a small community. It's just over 20,000, very tight-knit community, and a lot of local businesses have sprung up in the last few years. They've put a lot of money into keeping local business there. So that's really the true character of the community. And during the day, you see concerned parents. You see parents bringing kids out. I've seen kids as young as 5 and 6 actually taking part in marches or protests with their parents. And that's what's happening during the day. They just want to make certain their voice is heard, that the focus remains on trying to find out how an 18-year-old man was shot and killed by a police officer while he was unarmed. So that's what's happening during the day. During the afternoon, Ferguson is surrounded on all sides by other communities, and it appears people from those surrounding communities and even further, larger parts of the metro area are coming in, and the best thing to call them is opportunists. It's easier at night under the cover of darkness, it seems, to engage in violent acts, and that's what we're seeing happening.
And what do we know anything of the status of the police officer who actually fired those fatal shots?
We don't. Late last week, when Chief Tom Jackson of the Ferguson Police Department, when he released the officer's name, Darren Wilson, he said that he had been injured. He sustained some injury to the side of his face. There was swelling, possibly bruising. So we know that. However, Officer Wilson has been out of town for days before his identity was revealed, so we haven't heard anything else. We hope to gather more information. The St. Louis County prosecutor who's in charge of investigating the shooting is Robert McCullough. He announced that they anticipate a grand jury beginning sometime this week.
And just to go back to the presence of the National Guard in Ferguson, is there a fear that you're picking up on that could actually be a catalyst, much like the early, what was criticised as heavy-handed police response was met with such condemnation from the local community and wider American society, that the National Guard being there could actually trigger perhaps more violent street scenes?
I can tell you today, as opposed to the last 8 days, what has happened, the police presence has been increased. We're seeing multiple cop cars every block, and that's something that hasn't really been there. Police have sort of during the day kind of taken a step back, and this morning that has changed. So judging on how the police are treating it, they are definitely taking a more aggressive approach. Now, what does that mean tonight? I don't want to speculate on that. We'll see. We'll see what ends up happening.
Colin Jeffrey is the news director at KTRS in St. Louis. This is FSN Reports. Kurdish forces, supported by US airstrikes, are close to regaining control of the strategically vital Mosul Dam in northern Iraq from Islamic State fighters. The US air assault on IS targets was ramped up with the use of fighter jets, drones, and for the first time in this mission, bombers. Nearly 70 US strikes have been launched since August 8th to support Iraqi security forces, help with humanitarian efforts, and protect US interests and personnel in the country. Iraq-based reporter Faisal Harami discussed the battle for the dam with LBC Radio.
The American planes conducted around 17 airstrikes against the ISIS forces around the dam. And the Kurdish forces have advanced towards the dam. But as far as I know, the dam has not been taken completely. Most of it is under the Kurdish Peshmerga control, but it has not been taken. And the fighting goes on in other kind of front lines in southern Kirkuk, in a place called Jalawla, between ISIS and the Peshmerga forces. And as the military help arrives in Kurdistan, it seems that the Kurds are making more advances against ISIS. So the military help that comes from abroad, and it's very important for the Kurdish forces.
Of course it is. The US support, you've been talking about that. Has that really been helping the Peshmerga? And also, do you get a sense that they really have now got the modern equipment they need to take on IS?
I mean, this war, from the people that I've spoken to, it's more about like panic and morale. And this aid that comes from the Americans, it takes a few days, it takes about a week to reach the front line. But in terms of the fact that the Kurds know now the Western governments like the US and the UK and France are behind them, that raises their morale. And it's easy for them to take on the ISIS. Of course, like heavy artillery will help them to take on ISIS. But most of it, I would say, it's more about their morale and raising their morale. And now with the help that the British government and also the American government are providing, yes, that will definitely help in their fight against ISIS.
Iraq-based reporter Faisal Harami talking to LBC Radio's Lisa Aziz. Now, Ebola-hit countries in West Africa are experiencing increasing levels of civil unrest and social problems due to the effects of isolation caused by the disease. At least 1,145 people have now died in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea and Nigeria. Many countries are also shutting their airports to passengers from Ebola-affected nations. LBC's Nick Ferrari spoke to Sheldon Yett, UNICEF's representative in Liberia.
This is a city and a country really gripped by fear. This affects everything in daily life. In some respects, social norms have changed overnight. Certainly in Monrovia, an issue that we've always had is basic hygiene. In front of every office, in front of every building, there are large buckets full of chlorine, and people are very religiously washing their hands. That's obviously not the case in the slums and in the other parts of the city. People are afraid of crowds. People are afraid of gatherings. People are afraid of each other. So it is impossible to underestimate the impact this has had on the country, on daily life, and on children in this country. And that will continue to happen even after the Ebola outbreak is contained, because this has just absolutely decimated healthcare services. It's put schooling on hold. It's going to lead to many, many more orphans. So the impact of this will be felt for many, many years to come.
What precautions do you take?
Well, as an individual, I am very religiously washing my hands. I'm ensuring that anybody who comes into our office is checked to make sure they have to make sure they don't have a temperature. It's very important that we don't spread it into buildings. And that we keep all our staff safe and to ensure that it is not inadvertently transmitted. So before anyone can come in the front door, they have to stand in a line, and we have to ascertain they have no temperature and have no symptoms. I'm very careful of mixing in crowds, but you have to continue doing everything you can to address this.
LBC's Nick Ferrari with Sheldon Lett, UNICEF's representative in Liberia. This is FSN Reports. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange says he'll leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London soon, after 2 years inside the building. However, it remains unclear how or when he plans to leave his refuge or where he'll go. He's wanted for questioning in Sweden over sexual assault allegations that he denies. Mr. Assange claims he would end up being extradited to the United States to face charges over the leaking of classified documents by WikiLeaks. Ollie Barrett has more from outside the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
The question, of course, that most people here want an answer to is how soon is soon? Julian Assange saying that he will leave the Ecuadorian embassy soon, but not saying exactly how that would happen or why that would happen or when that would happen. Well, his WikiLeaks colleague and spokesman Christian Rafson has been speaking to me outside the Ecuadorian embassy here, and he says it could be imminent.
It's his hope that it will happen within days, and it could happen tomorrow. I mean, everything is in place here for the UK authorities to simply do the right thing and honour their obligations in accordance to an agreement that they signed, I believe, in 1951 to honour another country's political asylee status. and allow Julian to save passage to the airport and fly to Ecuador.
No sign at all, though, that British officials are about to reduce the police operation here in any way or step back from their obligation to arrest Julian Assange as soon as he sets foot on British soil. So there remains every possibility that Julian Assange could still be here at the Ecuadorian embassy for some time. And London reporter Tom Swarbrick from LBC Radio says that that is an issue which is angering many Londoners.
When he first addressed people when he arrived here 2 years ago, he stood on that balcony behind us and he addressed hundreds of people who were here. They're not here today. And that is perhaps an indication of his star sort of falling over the last 2 years.
The Ecuadorian embassy is a very small part, though, of this impressively façaded building in the exclusive Knightsbridge area of London. So for the last 2 years, Julian Assange has been eking out an existence in just a couple of rooms. Ollie Barrett, outside the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, the challenge taking tourists to some of the most complex destinations on Earth. With North Korea habitually and seemingly at random grabbing Americans who visit the country and introducing them to its communist gulag, with places like Tibet still complex for foreigners to navigate, and Cuba still subject to at least US restrictions on visits, there is now a new player in the game of exotic global travel. Political Tours is headed by a former New York Times Balkans correspondent, Nicholas Wood. Its aim, to allow intrepid travellers to visit any country that happens to be making global headlines, however challenging the itinerary. Nicholas Wood spoke to online radio station Monocle 24.
Political Tours literally sort of takes people inside the news. So we go to lots of different places around the world, usually led by a journalist, and we give people sort of an inside look at events in those countries. Now, sometimes that might be somewhere pretty close to home, like Scotland, looking at the debate on independence.
I didn't catch that. How are you voting next year on the referendum?
Or we might be going somewhere like Ukraine, which is a bit more sort of tricky, looking at the background to the conflict there, but also the revolution.
Some people are talking about independence completely. Some people are talking about wanting to join Russia, to be annexed by Russia. And some people are talking simply about more
power. So some of our destinations are very conventional and some of them are not conventional at all.
I think a common theme with all of our tours is to try and say, look, what makes this country tick? And often, in order to do that, you have to get away from the capital and you have to go somewhere a bit more remote. So if you take our tour of South Africa, where we look at South Africa post-apartheid, and we've got a tour coming up at the end of January, we start in rural KwaZulu-Natal and we visit very remote villages and we really see how people fare on a day-to-day basis. So where's their income coming from? What kind of problems do they face? It might be health, might be education. And from that, you get a pretty good idea of how to look at the rest of the country. You know, if you don't have an understanding of people's basic problems, in a way, you know, the bigger political issues are a bit more remote.
Give praise to the king, the one that lives within. Not of religion, but of tradition. Cause colour black still a victim in the powers of your system.
So in South Africa, that's where we start with those villages. And then we work our way up to Johannesburg. And then we meet with businesses. We go to the stock exchange. We look at mining. And over a week, you try and look all the different sort of sections in society. And you build up a sort of bigger and more complex picture. And then by the end of the week, you're actually meeting politicians and you're able to put the questions to them yourself. Ukraine used to be quite a big tourism destination, particularly for Russian speakers. You'd find a lot of people going to the Black Sea coast, and also perhaps less so for some people in Europe. You've had quite a few travel firms going there in recent years. But obviously the conflict has wiped most of that trade out. If you go there now, many of the big hotels
are empty. Yet, at the same time, Ukraine is a very big country, and the conflict really is in the Far East. So you can actually go to Ukraine now, you can stay in some really nice hotels, you can eat in very good restaurants, and you'll be welcomed with open arms. You know, Ukraine is actually very well worth going to, and at the moment it's somewhere that's suffering because of the war in the East. But in actual fact, as a tourism, you'd actually have a very, very good experience there. We had a very good trip in Ukraine where we went down to the Black Sea. We went to Odessa and we stayed in some very good hotels there. And the food in Ukraine is absolutely amazing. A year ago, we were in Greece. We had a very good tour there looking at really the background to Europe's, the Euro crisis, and how small businesses have been affected by that and how the country's been affected by it. But again, you know, Greece is somewhere that tourism had dropped off quite a bit during the economic crisis, I think really because of events across Europe rather than events in Greece itself. And so that had affected the local economy on some of those islands where they'd expected to have more customers. But, you know, still you could have, you know, a very good and worthwhile experience. And I think generally many of our customers want to go to places where it's not so packed with tourists. So in a way, there's a bigger reward, if you like, and people are actually much more welcoming and much more interested in you travelling there. Our main aim is to try and give people an understanding of the key issues in current affairs. And in some cases, that means going to a place that's had a conflict. And I think you've got to be very sensitive when you do that. We always work and travel with local journalists or analysts who've lived in the region or come from the region. And so they know the area very well. And we'll have contact with the local community. And it's very important not to be sensitive to what's happened in an area. So, for example, if we're going to go into a poorer area of a town, we'll often work with an NGO or a local community leader. So they will give us the introductions. And it works very well. People are very interested in explaining their situation to outsiders. And I think as a travel company and outsiders, you have a sort of moral and ethical responsibility, you know, not to be voyeuristic. You can't have sort of big sort of kind of bus tourism. You can't sort of gawp at other people's problems. You've got to do it with their consent. So I think that's okay as long as you do it, you put things into a context and you have good contact with the local community. I guess other places that you wouldn't go or would go to, I mean, our rule of thumb is we won't go to a place where there's an active conflict going on. We are actually going to Israel and the Palestinian territories in October. And it's a sad thing to say, but Israel and Gaza have seen this kind of conflict before. And yet at the same time, it's actually quite safe to travel around most of that region. And you just have to be sensitive to what's going on in a particular area and be ready to change your travel plans. But I think you can actually still learn a hell of a lot. I mean, you've got to be cautious about that kind of thing. And I said before, the main rule of thumb is to travel with people who know the area very well. And I think it's tremendously important to understand things from a community perspective. So if you have direct contact with local people and you have the guidance of somebody who really knows the area very well, you can learn a hell of a lot, so long as you're not exposing those people to any risks or yourself.
That's Nicholas Wood of Political Tours, and he was talking to Monocle 24. It's an online radio station based in London. You can listen to it anywhere and find it online at monocle.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact the show, email us reports@featurestory.com. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.